We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Papers podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Uma Tassie, Professor of Psychology. My research focuses on special educational needs and mental health in childhood and adolescence. In this series, we speak to authors of papers published in one of ACAM's three journals. These are the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, commonly known as JCPP, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health, known as CAM, and JCPP Advances. All listeners to this, and indeed any of ACAM's podcasts, are eligible for a free CPD certificate. Do please visit acamlearn.org for details of this, together with information on how you can access hundreds of hours of free talks, lectures, interviews, all of which you can also get free CPD certificates for. The web address is acamlearn.org. That's acamhlearn.org. If you're a fan of our Papers podcast series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues. Today I'll be speaking to Dr. Franjo Ivankovic, lead author of the paper Optimization of Self or Parent Report Psychiatric Phenotypes in Longitudinal Studies, published in the JCPP. Franjo, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with some introductions. Do you just want to introduce yourself, what you do, and what your research interests are, and where you work?
My name is Franjo Ivankovic. I am currently a postdoctoral research fellow at Mass General Hospital / Broad Institute / Harvard Medical School. And my primary research interests are really genetic and phenotypic variability in psychiatric disorders. And I'm fairly disorder agnostic, but I think I would say my research tends to focus more on obsessive compulsive and related disorders, so OCD, Tourette syndrome, and then eating disorders as well.
When you say disorder agnostic, is that you're not really fussed about which ones you look at, or you're interested in mechanisms that underpin lots of different disorders?
Well, if I bring up construct validity, I think we might be into a territory that's entirely of the primary topic for this podcast. But I kind of view psychiatric disorders as, let's say, not super well defined. So I don't tend to hyper-focus on a particular disorder. I tend to kind of see them more as a, let's say, multidimensional spectrum. And I'll go to the data sets that can answer interesting questions, essentially, regardless of what kind of psychiatric disorders have been phenotyped in that data set.
Give us some context. So the paper that we're going to talk about today, what's the problem that you're trying to address in this paper?
Yeah, so this actually wasn't really an intentional project from the beginning. I got my PhD in genetics and genomics, and so my training has been fairly squarely in the genetics and genomic aspect of psychiatric disorders. But my mentor at the University of Florida is a psychiatrist, and we were essentially collecting data from our ABCD study and defining phenotype, which of interest for us was OCD at the time. We saw that there was a general overrepresentation of OCD among adolescents in this study, particularly if you consider the fact that the sampling for this study was meant to be representative of different demographic characteristics of the United States, but the recruitment was in schools and it wasn't targeted for psychiatric symptoms, right? So at the time, I believe, at the release of the data that they had, I believe the prevalence of OCD was 13.5%, and that's kind of high for a bunch of 10-year-olds that are not sampled to have psychiatric symptoms, much less OCD. And so this kind of brought up a discussion of how to do a proper quality control on the phenotypes. And as it happens, concomitantly, another member of the lab, Luis Sordo Vieira, was working a similar approach in brain health registry data. And that data set is a little bit different from ABCD data set. It is mostly self-report. However, there's a subset of BHR that has been clinically validated. So essentially what they looked at in their paper was what is the best way leveraging longitudinal assessments in BHR to essentially QC the psychiatric phenotypes. And so what they found is that if they take any endorsement of a disorder as a threshold versus endorsements at most time points at which they were examined or temporally kind of consistent ones. What they found is that most and temporally consistent ones and all essentially have about the same rate of validation in the subset that was clinically examined as well. And then we essentially decided to do a similar thing in the ABCD data set in this mostly, entirely pediatric sample. And that was the project.
So when you said temporally consistent, so my understanding of what you're saying is if you ask young people a number of times about their symptoms of OCD in this example, like every year, for example, and if you find a threshold and see how many people are above a threshold, and if a child is above the threshold at any one of the N time points, three time points, let's say, that would give you the number of people who meet the threshold at any one time point. But the people who meet that threshold is much higher than what you would expect in the general population. So what you're suggesting is what this other study did was they looked at multiple time points and the people who consistently scored above a threshold. And in doing that, that gave them some indication of what the prevalence was of whatever condition you're interested in the study.
Yeah, correct. So I'm not too familiar with the way that the BHR works, but I believe it was also a self-report of having different disorders. So I don't think it's based on like questionnaires. I know for a fact that in ABCD data, it's based on a computerized form of the KIDI schedule for affective disorders and schizophrenia. And there, of course, what you have is the KSADS, which is normally a semi-structured interview meant to be administered by clinicians that has been essentially kind of turned into a questionnaire form and then computerized and essentially given on a tablet to parents / children. Modules were given differently. So some disorders were assessed in both parents and children. Some were assessed specifically in parents and some were assessed specifically in children. OCD, for example, was only parent assessed. And they would essentially go through the questionnaire on the tablet and the research assistants at the ABCD study would kind of do the calculations on the back end and determine what the diagnosis class is or diagnosis value is for a given time point. And these are assessed essentially cross-sectionally at, longitudinal over a period of time, but they're assessed at each time point. They don't take into account like values of the previous assessment.
Okay. And in the introduction of your paper, you talk about the low agreement between parent report, child report, and clinician report. Why might that be? Why do the different informants report different levels of mental health difficulties if the target child is the same?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in terms of parents and children, right, there's certainly an aspect of understanding what constitutes a functionally impairing level of symptom experience. I know certainly, a lot of us are familiar certainly with the fact that people colloquially tend to use certain psychiatric disorders and / symptoms to describe their everyday that are not necessarily right at that threshold of functional impairment. For example, people tend to say all the time that they have OCD because they like things organized, which is not necessarily the case. And so that can certainly be a source of over-endorsement. And then, of course, I feel like parents can have maybe a slightly distorted perception of what what their children are experiencing. And they are not always trained clinicians and they're not always necessarily trained to detect symptoms right as they are. So they might misinterpret certain things as well. And I think that's kind of where you get over-endorsement or under-endorsement, depending on like if the child is experiencing internalizing or externalizing type of symptoms.
So you've described the problem, which is people tend to over-endorse symptoms of mental health difficulties if they're reporting about themselves. And for various reasons, and parents might not also be able to get to the objective level of symptoms. And that's problematic because it leads to an inflation of the prevalence of apparent mental health difficulties in large population-based studies like the ABCD. So what did you want to do in this study? What were your research questions?
Yeah, so our research question was primarily, how can we take this data set? That is a great data set that has so many different aspects of these children's development assessed longitudinally? And how can we essentially overcome this quality control issue in terms of psychiatric phenotype determination so that it is useful for certain downstream analyses where sensitivity and specificity specifically are of paramount importance and can impact them significantly?
Excellent. Thank you. And you've already mentioned this a bit, so let's just hopefully you can describe it in a bit more detail. You've already talked about the ABCD study. Can you just tell us a bit more about what the study is, what its aims were, what the sample size is like, who was recruited, and what the follow-ups are like?
So Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Study, ABCD study, is a American NIH initiative where they wanted to track longitudinal development of children. And so the study targets subjects or participants when they are just about to essentially enter adolescence, about the time when they're 9 to 10 years old, and then tracks them for the period of 10 years and essentially their exit when they're about 19/20 years old. And I believe the study was primarily meant to assess risks of development of substance use disorders. However, their approach in assessment is very broad. So they're assessing, you know, psychiatric disorders through KSADs. They assess that every year on an annual basis. And in the early arms of the study, most of the assessments are given to parents. Some are given to children, but as the study progresses. And of course, there's extensive neuroimaging that's also involved in the study. So MRI, they are genetically assessed as well. So at the beginning of the study, they collect their blood/saliva, and they've essentially genotyped this group of people. They administer a lot of quantitative type of scales to children, such as, for example, a child behavioral checklist, CBCL, which assesses also psychiatric symptomatology. They have pretty extensive demographic assessments. So, you know, socioeconomic status, racial background, ethnic background. They assess sex, gender, sexual orientation. So they're fairly thorough in terms of capturing different aspects of these kids' lives. And they do this essentially, I believe, it depends on the specific data modality, of course, but psychiatric phenotypes, some batteries are also administered like at a half year point, some are administered every year. And with psychiatric phenotypes specifically, for example, they don't get the entire spread of KSADs all the time. For example, OCD is assessed once every 2 years. Psychosis is assessed every year. They do assess like drug and alcohol use disorder. These are assessed, I believe, every other year in parents. And then now they're assessing them every year in the children, right? So it varies a lot how they're administering these assessments, but it's wide breadth of data. There's like about, I think, like a few hundred to a couple of thousand, like different modalities that you can look at.
Yeah, it seems very extensive. So you've mentioned KSADs, so KSADs. So is that the only measure that you used? And just give us an indication of which mental health conditions we're going to talk about in terms of your analysis.
So the ABCD study assessed psychiatric disorders through the computerized form of KSADs. And they've essentially assessed pretty much the entire KSADs battery. So that includes, you know, mood disorders like depressive bipolar disorder, disruptive mood regulation disorders, psychosis, anxiety disorders like panic disorder, separation anxiety disorder, social phobia, specific phobias, general anxiety disorder, OCD, eating disorders, ADHD, the conduct disorders like oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder, tic disorders, and autism spectrum disorders, which are neurodevelopmental disorders, alcohol use disorder, drug use disorder, PTSD, sleep problems, and then also suicidality and homicidality. The ones that they don't administer were enuresis and encopresis. I believe that's probably because they're past the developmental period where they would experience these, and then also selective mutism. And I think that about covers all of the KSADs modules. I'm not entirely sure.
Very comprehensive. We've got the ABCD study. It's a longitudinal study, and there's been lots of measures. What did you find?
Interestingly, at the time of the assessment, this was a release version 4 when I did these analyses. They had pulled several modules back because they have noticed similar issue where there was over-endorsement of psychiatric phenotypes. So they had pulled a depression module, a disruptive mood regulation disorder module, agoraphobia module, eating disorders module, and then ADHD and autism modules. Essentially, what they did is that they had adjusted the programming on how the thresholds were calculated in order to improve the classification, right, of individuals. So those were not analyzed in this paper because they were essentially removed from the study to be reprocessed. And so our question was, are the rest of the disorders following similar trend and should they also be reconsidered in terms of programming errors? And so when we did what we're calling in the paper broad disorder classification, that is if they have, so if an individual who has been assessed, let's say 3 times for a disorder, if they endorse having this disorder at any time point, so you know, at the entry follow-up 1 or 2, they would be classified as having this disorder. And then when we did that, what we found is that essentially across the board, the rates of endorsements were higher than what you would anticipate in children in this specific population that was considered in ABCD based on the literature report. So what we did is we tried to pull essentially as best as possible data from the reference materials to assess the prevalences and compare that to what the prevalences were in ABCD study. And what we found is that essentially across the board, except for like a couple of disorders like panic disorder and bulimia nervosa, I believe, the rates were higher and in some cases, you know, like 10 times higher than what you would actually anticipate in kids of this age. That kind of led us to think about how we correct this. And so one way that we've come up with is essentially setting a narrow diagnosis construct. And the narrow diagnosis construct is predicated on the assumption that you need to have endorsed this disorder over 50%, not at least 50%. So if you were assessed twice for a disorder, for example, for OCD, they have only taken it at 2 time points, they would have to endorse OCD at both time points in order to be classified as having the disorder.
Did you see in any evidence that the extent to which people were over-endorsing was for the conditions that there's high levels of public awareness of the symptoms of those conditions?
That's a great question. So not in particular, you know, I think the disorders that were most over-endorsed, and I mean in a relative way, were psychosis and bipolar disorder. And I would not anticipate people to be more familiar with bipolar disorder than they are with, let's say, ADHD. I mean, in general public, ADHD or autism or OCD, for example. OCD was still over-endorsed. The rates of OCD reported compared to what we considered the reference rate, which was 2.5%, was about 5 to 6 times, or I think BD1 was kind of almost 10 times more prevalent than reference rate. But then if you think like specific phobias, for example, which are also fairly well known in terms of symptomatology, right, was maybe like 1.8 times the reference prevalence rate. So nothing extreme. Or, you know, social phobia was actually about well-matched to the reference prevalence rate. Tic disorders, which I guess at the time were not as familiar, because I think in about 2020, we had that swath of TikTok tics, where the Tourette syndrome kind of became fairly well-known among the general public, but at the time was not. It was also fairly over-endorsed. It doesn't seem like there is a awareness-driven association. I guess I would imagine if that's, I mean, I haven't asked this specific question, but I would imagine that the drive for the overendorsement in a lot of cases was maybe overestimation of some externalizing symptoms, let's say.
So your working hypothesis is that it's not that people are necessarily more aware of certain symptoms and they're reporting those more. It's the symptoms that people are aware of. They're interpreting the severity of those more.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, excellent. What are the implications of this for other researchers who use other studies, like myself? So like we use population-based studies all the time where we have self-report measures of common mental health conditions like depression and anxiety. And then from that, we infer certain things. Is this likely to be a problem across the board on this kind of cohort study, population level investigations? And if so, is the recommendation that we use a similar approach to what you're suggesting, which is if you've got multiple time points, see what's been endorsed at multiple time points?
I do think that studies that rely on, and in fact, I will actually say even in electronic health records data, I guess maybe a little bit of background there. So electronic health records data, right, are data that are fetched from in different data banks where people contribute their medical history in terms of codes that are associated with specific disorders. And what we see is that even in those data, which are essentially determined primarily by physicians, right, they're the ones assessing diagnoses, you also see, not as extreme, but some rate of overendorsement of psychiatric disorders. So it is certainly a pervasive challenge with respect to psychiatric disorders data. And I do think that it definitely indicates that some degree of quality control of the phenotypes is absolutely necessary. However, of course, a lot of data collections are cross-sectional. That is, they're assessed at a single time point. And the issue there, right, is of course, we lack the longitudinal data, right? So we don't know how to best QC that. But with respect to longitudinal data, at least, I think one way to look at the quality of phenotypes would be to consider the longitudinal trajectories of endorsements and see if in your particular study, the longitudinal endorsements are consistent or if they vary a lot. And I guess if they do vary a lot or they're inconsistent, then I'd be worried a little bit. And there's various reasons, right, why longitudinal assessments would be inconsistent. I mean, obviously, yeah, a person could have a false endorsement of a psychiatric disorder or false positive, but you could also have a false negative, right? Like recall bias is certainly a thing, and people can, you know, forget that they had experienced a specific disorder, especially if they're in remission or are no longer experiencing symptoms and are far away from that period of life where they are bothered by the symptoms that they were experiencing. They can miss that they had it. Yeah.
Why might people who work for a national health service or the health service or clinicians who are not doing it for a research study, why might those estimates be biased upwards? Because those are the people who are entering the data onto the administrative data sets.
That's another great question. I'm not very familiar with British healthcare systems. I can't really speak to UK, but in the US, certainly, the way that healthcare system works, there's fairly limited duration in the clinic in terms of contact between a physician and a patient. And putting aside, let's say, coding errors, which can certainly occur, right? So when you have a diagnosis in mind and you go enter the ICD code and you start typing something, for example, let's use the case of anorexia, medical anorexia, which is just a absence of appetite, and then anorexia nervosa, which is a psychologically driven thinness and absence of appetite, right? So let's say you go in and you start typing anorexia, and then you accidentally, right, choose anorexia nervosa instead of medical anorexia, which can occur. But I think the limited duration of contact can lead to, you know, maybe not as thorough assessments, which people on the research side have the privilege of, right? Essentially administering multiple batteries and multiple tests and different kind of assessment tools to triangulate the diagnosis. In a medical setting, you might get, you know, PHQ or patient health questionnaire, which will assess for, you know, depressive symptoms, and you can get some qualitative interview, which would lead a physician to establish an MDD diagnosis or something like that. But in reality, patient could have a different mood disorder to which depression is just an aspect of the diagnosis, but there's not enough time to essentially assess that, or they haven't spent enough time to breach the relevant questions that could lead them to assess a more appropriate diagnosis, you know, such as maybe bipolar or whatever.
It's really interesting because I think that in the UK at the moment, there's more and more large administrative data sets are being linked and being made available for researchers to use for research. And, mm-hmm. you know, everybody is aware that there's no such thing as a perfect data set. So it's interesting to have this conversation around some of the limitations of those, potential limitations of those administrative data sets. Because I think the challenges that you describe for physicians in the States, I imagine is similar. Some of those are similar to the UK and other parts of the world, especially those ones around time limited or limited time during a consultation. Let's move on to the future. So I know you said your training is behavior genetics and the genomics. What on this topic around measurement of psychiatric phenotypes, do you have more work planned or in general, more broadly, what have you got coming up?
Yeah, so I think, well, nosology has become one of my passions through this specific project, but also assessment of psychiatric phenotypes and phenotype-related questions. So they have become an integral part of my genetic studies as well. And I think they will kind of thread through in that aspect, certainly, for a fairly long time. Thinking off top of my head, I don't have specific projects that are of the same nature as this one queued up yet, but if I will probably run into a data set that will have similar type of issues and is going to present similar type of challenge. And yeah.
And what's your take home message for the listeners?
For the researcher listeners, I would certainly say it's important not to take phenotypes at face values, even when we think of these batteries as well, or specific questionnaires or batteries, right, that are well established and have been used for a very long time. They are not perfect. And, you know, I would caution against over-relying on these assessments because, again, time point to time point variability can be present. And especially for the researchers who also do genetics or neuroimaging studies, where slight changes in the specificity and sensitivity of your phenotyping can kind of lead to cascading effects down into your you know, neuroimaging or genetic study, taking phenotypes at a face value can have drastic and negative effect that cannot be really picked up unless you ask specifically if your phenotypes are what they're supposed to be.
Thank you. That's fascinating and really, really interesting conversation there around phenotype, psychiatric phenotype measurement. Thank you so much. For more details on the paper, please visit the ACAM website. That's www.acam.org and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget, follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with your friends and colleagues.